This is tape three, side one of an interview with Mr. Ari Foreman, 6624 Rutland Street, Philadelphia 19149, 725-6285 on October 26, 1981 with Josie Fisher.
October. It's exactly the month when I...
That's right.
Yeah. And funny enough that I came to the United States was also in October. So here we are, the gold taken away, everything taken away. When we came out from the other side, who was lucky could find his baggage, who was not lucky, he was left without it. And now we are all led again through the river, through that mud, where you would go in like you go in and, you know, like sinking in. And that mud to go, they couldn't take us straight to the on the road, they had to take us to the mud, so you drop some more or you fall down maybe alone and remain there. I remember a cousin of mine, and whenever I'm in Israel, they live in Israel, one part of these this group of our family, he always reminds me they had a baby then and they came with a carriage. And I was very athletic, so we went to, so you, how can you carry, go with wheels, with a carriage to the mud. So they called me, and I was so strong enough that I took the whole carriage, and I took it to that place where we were shipped over to the other side. And he always reminds me about it. Do you remember you did this in 41 when we went together over from Otaki to Mogilev.
And that family survived then?
Yeah, yeah, all of them survived that. But from the 85 or 80, how many were there? Around 80, 80 some. I think we were left, my family, thank God, came by, my father, mother, and my sister and I came back in one piece, how to say. And then a few cousins, most of them live in Israel, but the rest is, I think we came back about maybe 12 from the whole amount. And they didn't die, none of them died from any, poisons or how you call it, killed actually, just died. From hunger, from disease, from dirt, from name it, you know. So here we are, they took us over to the other side. And here comes, now we are already in Mogilev. There again, gendarmes waiting for us. And it's about, they took over probably, we were about 50 people, maybe less. In this thing to be able to go over with that wire, how they moved it, some people were turning something and it moved forward and back on that one wire what holds it from the, you know, to go, not go with the stream of the Neser. Mm-hmm. On the other side again, gendarmes, about four I think, with these rifles, and they formed in a group, and now we have to walk through town. They're supposed to take us to a place where they have to sort us, where we should go and what to do. But, and these four, now, if you didn't have any luggage, you could run away and just stay in Mogilev. If you had luggage, they recognized you that you are a newcomer and they would grab you. We didn't know that, okay? So, while we were walking, people were Jews, a lot of Jews were from before, they came up to us and told us what's happening now. Now, every one of our family somehow did a kind of crazy thing. One of my aunts all of a sudden made believe she fainted in the middle of the street and started to scream and ask, you know. And the soldier, seeing her lie, go to hell, and she left there. And then she got up and ran away. A young man is coming to me and says, my age, he says, you know what we can do? I can help you to run away from here. to at least to stay here in Mogilev. Because we learned later that all the people who were going there in that sorting place where like it was a burned down kazarm where soldiers used to be years ago, all those people are sent on the other side of the Bug to the Germans. And from there was no return. And I was there, that was the end. If you were caught to be in that kazarm, and then they ship you over, and then you never come back. So this guy came and says, "You want to run away?" I said, "How? I have this thing." He says, "Look, I'll grab you, you'll give me this, your rucksack, I'll run away, and you'll run after me, and that will be fine." Okay. He maybe thought that he'll be outrun me, and he'll run away with my, because you became an animal, actually, very fast, you know, in a situation like that. So he was running an eye after him, and I caught him. Okay, he wasn't really, it was very nice, how to say. He said I should give him something, and I gave him two shirts. And he was very thankful. He was a Jewish boy. Mm-hmm. But he came who they wouldn't let, they couldn't bring with them anything. They were those also, but they came just like they were, with no baggage, with no nothing. And he was already there, he says, for a month, and he didn't even have anything to change, a shirt or this. So this was for him. I never met the guy later on. It was like a one-time encounter. And everybody of my family, my mother, my father, my sister, and her fiancé, in some other place, was able to get out before. And my mother was the last to get out. And she says, to her it was like, she was very religious, you know. And she said it was a miracle. And she told us how it was. She felt that some angels came and saved her. It was her way of interpreting. Some three men came after her and she says, "Follow us." And somehow she followed them. It was about maybe 100 yards before to get into that. It was like the last moment, and somehow she was saved. And the next day, there was like a marketplace. And everyone of us was on the market looking for each other, and then we somehow met there. Now, the whole town of Mogilev at that time, the lower part near the Dniester has been for, I think, 3-4 days underwater. But underwater, like to the half of this house. So all the houses we were being in were wet. The walls, you would touch the wall, your hand would just go into the wetness, you know. And we had to stay in these kind of houses to run away, not to be deported further on.
There was no checking in the town of people who had run away from the line?
It was impossible, mm-hmm. because there were so many there. They really didn't care. They knew that we are in their hands anyway. Sooner or later, they'll get us. And really what happened in later months was that they formed a kind of police, a kind of Jewish police, but had to deliver so many Jews each day to be sent to Vapnyarka, that was on the other side of the Bug. And those people never came back. Once out, so they knew that they had us in our, unless you had an authorization from the mayor, not the mayor, the major of the town, the Romanian mayor, because they were Germans also. But Germans didn't have to do with us anything, only the Romanians. We were just under the jurisdiction of Romanian army. Mm-hmm. So when we had the only thing what you could stay is you had an authorization that you are a useful Jew and they need you in this town, they could not pick you up. So the other ones who did not have that were slowly deported. I was a youngster and I wasn't, I like to do things, to work in this. being that I had this background of dentistry and all this, what I learned in my, I got somehow, it's a whole story how I got into work for the sanitary service of the city. I became a disinfector. In other words, I was baking lice. And I was somehow, it's a whole story. And then I became sick. And I started to work, and I was lucky enough I had typhus.
When you say you boiled lice, you mean you were cleaning the clothes of the people?
Yes. In other words, if you you would, you know, you imagine a situation living one with another in these places, the lice were like crawling all over.
If you were working, that means that you were, your name was on a list, you were known
yes.
to be in this town.
Yeah.
Was it considered a ghetto?
Yes. They made a ghetto.
They made a ghetto of Mogilev.
Yes.
And this is where this occurred then.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. And there were hundreds and hundreds dying. Every day hundreds of them. And the clothes had to be disinfected.
You're talking about from the people who had died then?
Yes.
Yes.
Yes. And this is what I was doing, baking lice. Until I got sick also, myself.
You said you got typhus.
Yes.
At that point.
And somehow, being that I was that strong, and young, and with whole energy, I survived it, with no medicine. I remember an episode in that hospital, and I was delirious and this, and there were other kids and youngsters and people. And there was that young girl nearby saying, screaming to her mother that she had, sie stecht mich. How do you say in English, stecht mich? In other words, she has a kind of pinching sensation in her body. And she was screaming all the time, it pinches, it hurts her somewhere. So I say, take a knife and pinch back. Mm-hmm. So later her mother came and she tells her mother, mother, give me a knife. She said, why do you want it? I want to pinch back. She was already almost, you know, it was like a delirium type of, she died later on, this young girl.
But Mogilev became a ghetto when? After you arrived?
Yes, after we arrived. A little bit later. They made it smaller because they had to have the Ukrainian part. So they made like a concentration in the town.
And the Romanians were in charge of the
yes.
ghetto?
Yeah, we had to build the by voluntary work, how to
mm-hmm.
say, we had to build that kind of, you couldn't go over to the other side. Because at checkpoint you had to show if you're allowed to go out, if you are needed there, then you could get out. And then at night you were never allowed to be out of there. You had to be inside. Now.
You were working within the walls of the ghetto, so.
At first. Yeah, later on they sent me to an Ukrainian hospital to work there. But and I was working, I was everything there, name it, and I was there. Now, like when we found ourselves, there were already a lot of our family who died. At the first month, don't forget, people who had no desire of living, people who had no, they thought that that's the end anyway. They gave up hope. Those people were the first to die. And who were those people? Mainly intellectuals. The simple people survived more than intellectuals because they weren't thinking that far. They were struggling for survival. That was their aim. We have to survive. There is no other way. Those who didn't have that drive of wanting to survive could died the first few months.
You and your immediate family then were able to live together in the ghetto?
Yes, mm-hmm. yes. And I was actually, being I was then, what, 18, I was the one who had this authorization obtained that I'm a useful Jew, and they shouldn't touch me. And on that basis was for the family also.
I see.
Automatically. For Now we immediately then try to form all kind of cultural activities to help out the moral. And I remember he's still alive, there was an actor, his name is Popliker. He's still in Romania. He was an actor from way back. And he organized the theater. And I, I didn't mention that. I was in the 40s, when the Russian came, I used to play an instrument before, like mandolin and violin. And then I started to play the flute in 1940. I went to school especially for it. And in concentration camp, I was a part of this group by playing the flute.
You're talking now about the ghetto in Mogilev.
Yes, yes.
They formed an orchestra.
No, they formed a theater.
The theater.
Yes. Uh-huh. And they needed a part where I will of a peasant playing the flute.
I see.
And I had been a part of that. Mm-hmm. Okay, we have never been able to really perform because it came then an ordinance that we are not allowed to do it. Because all these things were actually for bringing up the morale of the people, you know, giving him hope, and giving him what to live for in the future. And basically, like I said before, if you die by being gassed, or you die just because you have no food, or sometimes you would prefer to die just and that's the end, instead of going through this whole hell of dying slowly by hunger, there were hundreds and hundreds who died, just fell on the street, blown up like a balloon from no food. There were, you imagine, the lice, you could see lice walking on the streets, let's put it this way. And the typhus exanthematicus, what is called with an eczema, in other words, it was enough that one louse was biting a sick person and then somehow walk over to a healthy person and he'll bite him also, the person will get sick. And there was millions, only those who became then later, if they had the sickness, they were immune already, so they could not get it again. You can have it once in your lifetime. So those are actually really the survivors or whoever. All these other ones who did not become immune, and this they really died, and there was no way of return. There was not no medicine, very little. Later on, I remember, like in 43, the joint came already in. With clothes and with things, like it was already like everybody already knew that something is happening, that the Red Army is advancing in this and that. It started to become a little easier, how to say, because you had already a kind of little light somewhere. You see in the darkness, but until that point, the misery was enormous.
You said that you were not permitted to put on the play that you had practiced.
Yes.
It took place.
No. We had already, we practiced a long time. It was, everything was set. The day of the performance came an ordinance, like a thing from the mayor of the city. Mm-hmm. Major is major, I think. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's like before colonel is major, yes? He was the leader of the town, the military leader, and an ordinance came, they locked up, and they wouldn't let us perform.
Was there also some effort towards education for any of the children in the ghetto?
I don't really know, because we didn't have any at that point. I know that there were no schools, let's put it this way. You observed all the holidays. Funny enough is that you didn't have what to eat, but when it came Yom Kippur, you didn't really eat. Mm. And you really kept, or when we had this Passover. Usually Passover, you are not allowed to eat cornmeal. So I just forgot, we are always interrupted with this telephone. What was the last thing
you're
I was?
You're talking about the Passover.
Oh, yes. So you imagine there were rabbis and there were everything you had in the camp, because you had doctors and everything, Jewish doctors, and there were plenty of them deported. So they gave out a decree that you are allowed to eat cornmeal, because we didn't have any. All the breads and everything was made mixed with cornmeal. You didn't get wheat or this. The bread was like if you put a finger, it doesn't bounce back, but you go in and it stays in. So because it was mixed with all kind of other meals, so he gave us a decree that you're allowed Passover to eat this. So you can actually is pikuach nefesh, in other words, to be able to survive.
Mm-hmm.
One episode I just remembered. The last I'm going back now in 41, before we were deported. Okay, when the whole thing it happened, that it fell exactly when we had the high holidays in Chernobyl before we were deported.
Mm-hmm.
So we didn't have any more synagogues. It was already the German and Romanian Nazis there. So what happened? We had in houses. They were made. You were not allowed to concentrate big amounts of people. You know, that was one of the ordinances that came out.
Mm-hmm.
So we had to take our heart in our hands to form all kind of little places where you could concentrate 40, 50 people only in pray and have like little synagogues. So I remember my uncle, one of the uncles who actually died in concentration camp, the husband of my aunt, what is 95 now in Israel, in their home we formed a synagogue. And it was the Yom Kippur, and my grandfather was there, the Zayda, and all the family. It was only for close people, it wasn't for outsiders. So we were praying, and it comes to Nile, you know, it comes when you have to blow the shofar, and the guy who was supposed to blow the shofar wasn't able to blow it. And if you don't blow shofar, you cannot go eat. And he was struggling, trying to blow that shofar, and he couldn't. So I said, give me, I'll try it. And I blew the shofar, because I knew a little bit about playing the flute, so I was able to. And this was, how to say, the last happiness, actually, the last joy of my Zayda, who later on, I told you before, died, and we never seen him. Just one of the, there are flashbacks of all kind of episodes,
yeah.
What I remember, and it's probably already so many tapes you have here. Okay.
Doesn't matter.
Yeah. Okay, so... where have we been now? I was talking about Passover.
Passover.
Yeah. So this is what happened. There were all kind of ways of trying to survive. I forgot another episode. What was really the main how you say it? The stone. So how is that the basis? How you say there is a backstone? No. There is a word what you say, the backbone. Oh,
mm-hmm.
The backbone of our being able to really start to stay there. You had no money. There was like marks, but it was like these marks you couldn't use anywhere else. It was made especially for Transnistria. They have special money for that. And to be able to survive, you had to do something at first until you really started to know where you are. So. My mother, she rest in peace, she had always to take care of food. That was her, so what is she carrying? Now gold you are not allowed to have, because I told you they took it away already in Otaki.
Mm-hmm.
You had to drop it in that bucket and they took off it. You didn't take it off, they found it. So now she has this side sack, like a sack. What is she carrying there? She carries marmalades and breads and things to have to nourish her family, so to be able to survive. So the guy there looks in what she has. Now when we arrived in Mogilev and we started to sell from us everything. I mean, they had this, all these peasants from the surroundings used to come and buy. So you take off a shirt, you sell it to buy food. And all other things, you start slowly, slowly until you are almost naked. But my mother had, in this jar of marmalade, she had a big gold watch with a chain hidden. She really took her... She had really courage. She didn't say, my father, he would have known, he was always so afraid of everything. If he would have known that she has that, he would take it out and give it away. But she was smart enough not to tell anybody about it. And when we arrived there, that was really the lifesaver. Mm-hmm. Because we immediately could get a big amount of money for that. Mm-hmm. And we could find a place, we could stay for a while, mm-hmm. where to live there. And the first thing what we started out to do is to sell latkes, potato latkes. With the money what we had here, my mother ran out and bought potatoes on the market and wrapped them in this. And we had a niece of ours who was with us, we were going out and sell the latkes for this, and then we started to make already. People were hungry there all the time. So this was how we really started to be able to survive in that. Later on was already, being that I was able to obtain this kind of, nobody wanted this job because they were afraid. If you get caught by one of these lies, that would be the end of it. But I didn't care. I mean, I watched out, but at a certain point, I became immune, being that I was already sick anyway. Mm-hmm. So for me, it was nothing. And it was for me like a lifesaver, how to say, because on this basis, we were able, all of us, to survive, and nobody... they have the saying, if you have enough years to live, you survive. You know, this really how it... later in years, like I said, like we were there for 3.5 years. We started in October, and October 41, and we were there till March 44. And then we were freed by the Russian army.
How did that happen?
Now that is a episode for itself. Now we knew, you know, we had some people had radio, so they heard there was the underground, the partisans and everything. So rumors, we knew exactly about what's happening. We knew about, I'm talking about now general happenings, that the Russian army is advancing, that they invaded Europe, the American army landed in this, and you already heard that it's going to a better... So, okay, the difference only between those who were in a situation like we were, in a camp like that, in a camp where there were two types. There were Vernichtungslager and a concentration lager. It means those where you were, Vernichtung means destruction, extermination, and that was just you would die alone. The only chance what we had in plus is that we had at least a chance to survive. And the other ones had no chance, unless...
You had a fairly clear idea then of what was happening in the extermination camps.
Yes.
When you were in
at that, no. At later years, we still did not realize exactly what was going on, because it was so. The secret of it was so kept so strongly. I mean, they really kept it so that they could convince the people to go, even not to. Everybody thought that it's going somewhere to where it will be better for him.
The contact that some of the people had with the underground and the partisans, as you pointed out before, did this mean that anybody from your group tried to escape, or?
There were, at a certain moment, when the joint came in already, like in 43, I think, there were already Unterhandlungen, how you say Unterhandlungen, there were already talks now, between the leaders of the Jewish people, because immediately they formed a federation in this, you know, always like that, where Jews are, they immediately formed. And they already had a kind of connection somehow.
This is tape 3, side 2 of an interview with Mr. Ari Foreman, 6624 Rutland Street, Philadelphia, 19149, 725-6285, on October 26, 1981, with Josie Fisher.
Yes, so when the episode of being freed is a very, yeah, I was talking about,
talking
yeah,
about
yes, about the children, yeah. About the things that were going on. They already tried at that point, they're starting to try that all the children were left, without parents, orphans.
The orphans, yes.
It should be somehow taken out from there. There were some doings, and I think even, I don't recall 100%, but I think a group has been, because I told you, with the Romanian, we had at least that one choice that you could bribe them.
Who was trying to get the orphans out of the ghetto?
The Jews from Romania got in touch with the Jews from here, and even a delegate, a guy from Bucharest, came to see the situation in Transnistria, because they were also kept in the dark. They didn't know what's really going on even here. So they came, and it was a kind of the discussion occurred with the government and this, and they seen already, you know, at that point that it is already like senile, how they say. It's like the last card what they play, the Romanians, and the Germans for that matter also, because it was already, it was after Stalingrad, it was after the Moscow siege, and it was already the Normandy thing, and it was, already they could see that there will be no too long. Now it was only a question of survival.
Who from Bucharest was able to come?
From the Federation, from the Jewish Federation.
How did they permit that?
With bribes, with how did they permit to let in the joint bring clothes?
Again, it was through bribes.
Of course. Mm-hmm. How else? I remember they had in Mogilev, they had, piles of things that were just thrown in there in these big big storage places, and whoever knew somebody, whoever this, they would bring him in there and will close him from top to the bottom with shoes and things. Because I'm sure that here in the United States, they collected things and this, and to get it there wasn't that easy. It was meant to be given really to everybody. But you know, until it really comes to the needy, half of it is lost somewhere on the way. And even then, when it comes to wherever you were in the camp that you could get something, you had to have to know somebody who gave you a kind of idea how to get in there and get something.
Was there a Jewish council in the?
It wasn't a council. It was a Jewish group. Yes, a kind of type of federation.
They were responsible for making these connections with the Jews outside of the
more or less. First of all, was the police, what I told you before, who was put there to put together people, and they would like. And even they, it's not good to tell you about your own people that they were bad, but they were, because if they were able to maneuver whoever. You would bribe them also to be able to, so, but they had to give the number. You see, you couldn't get away.
There were transports, regular transports,
yes.
Then that were picked.
Yes. So you had to, I mean, the first years, you know, later on it eased up. But at first, it was like permanent transporting groups. And they had to give so many a day. And what they used to give, the sick ones and who couldn't walk and who couldn't talk and everything, who couldn't resist, who couldn't put any resistance. Like my cousin here, what he lives here, his family, his father, mother, sister and brother died. Now, the father and mother died immediately, but the sister and the older brother, both are older than him, they had typhus. And they were already almost out of it, like they were still convalescent in the home, because it was like the end of it. So they needed people, so they walked in there, picked him up. His name was Philip Fiku, and his sister Betty, who was also there. The only sister, the smaller sister, Sidi, was with us already. She was living with us because she didn't have parents. She was a 15 years, a little girl yet, I mean a youngster. So those two were picked up as a part of a group to be exported, to be deported. Mm-hmm. So he, when they came in, they said they are taking him for a checkup to a hospital. So he says yes. He didn't even put on his shoes. He went in the sneaker, in the
slippers.
Winter. You know, and she also, and the only thing we heard later on, because he had, I remember, he used to have a very heavy coat, and somebody has then told us that they took away this coat from him, and that was the end, that he never returned, and that he went away, actually, and that was the end of it. It was horrible stories about different things, but even Jewish people used to do. I mean, you own people sometimes, all these kapos they are called, mm-hmm. in the was similar. Okay, that was more horrifying than ours, mm-hmm. But even here you send innocent people because you need it, and maybe you cannot blame even these people doing it, because they knew if you don't give the amount, you'll be taken. It's like a knife with two ends who will pinch you both sides. So you had to work hard to be able to put together that that group. Now, with freeing us was a very funny. We knew already now that the Russian army is very close. We didn't know exactly how close, but we knew that they are close. So really, what happened is all of a sudden we get this. This shooting, okay. Being that we were on the border of the Dniester was actually a point where they can hold back. So on this side is Otaki, where the town will be, and here is Mogilev. In the middle is the nest. We heard that that night they'll break the bridge. When you break up a bridge, a railroad bridge, it means that it's very close, something. So the first thing what they did is they cut that bridge in half. And we were very close. The whole house almost fell apart from that. We were about maybe 300 yards from that bridge. Now, all of a sudden, the main what we really understood that really something is going on, that there were columns and columns of motorized soldiers and tanks and everything going to that one bridge left, what was not a railroad bridge, but a regular bridge, what we built, actually, the Jews there for them. So they were retracting, they were coming from three or four directions, or from north, or from south, or from east, going all the way to this bridge. And this bridge could take just so much. So what really happened is, one tank, and they told us later on what really happened, these partisans captured a German tank, got into German clothes, and went in this column with all the people, you know, going towards the bridge. And then when they came to the bridge, they stopped and they ran out and screamed out, "The Ivan is here." Ivan, there was a synonym for the Russian, Ivan, you know. Mm-hmm. Ivan is an owl. Ivan is here. Mm-hmm. Now, if they heard Ivan is here, they started to fight. Like the Germans would fight with the Romanians, that they should be first to cross and not the Romanians. Mm. And you imagine, here you have a tank and this has a, and they started shooting, and when you heard shooting, the people who had the bridge to blow up the bridge in the last second thought that it's really already fighting there, that they really are there. So they blew up the bridge and everything was left on this side. And everybody jumped to all these officers and changed clothes into civilians, they run into the water and swim over the nest. It was a whole house. And for 24 hours, there was nobody in the town. There was no Germans and no Russians, because they said it was still far away. The only law in town was like one tank of partisans. And I was then, 20, I think, or so. So I was interested to see how a partisan looks. I never seen it. So I decided to walk out to see the partisan. And we knew where it is. So some torn up clothes with you know how a partisan can look. You think he's a hero, he's a human being and has nothing to eat just like you don't have or anything like that. And here we see him with a rifle in the hand, with a tank there, with a flag there. And with a red flag on it, and they are the, nobody is there, no Romanians, no Germans, no Russians. Do you imagine everybody was already hungry in this, so everybody ran and from these cars, because there are columns from all the sides, cars. Nobody there, cars alone. So you open, you ran into the cars and grabbed blankets what you didn't have, and food and chocolate. I haven't seen chocolate for 3.5 years. Mm. And Germans had that when they wanted to bribe you with something, like be nice to you, they would give you a piece of chocolate. So when we came to these cars, the first thing what I was looking for, chocolate, because I knew that everybody has in this car chocolate. So I picked up chocolate, I picked up a few blankets, and people were really, I mean, they found cars of sugar in cars, because everybody was trying to get away. And everybody took whatever he could to just make a little bit easier their life, because they never had it. The only thing, what I picked up, there was a factory of an oil factory in not too far from us. And I always wanted, we didn't have enough wood, you know, winter time. And was nesting cold, and we didn't have what to really burn. So what we did, the house where we were living in was half broken. So If it would hold on the lung more, the whole house would have collapsed over us. Because every day I was going out and pull a piece of wood from somewhere. And to be, so my dream was to have enough of that. So when you make oil, they leave, when they press out the oil, it's called makucha in Russian. It's kind of brick, a big round brick, where they press out from the machine the oil, and that is good for burning. So what I did, I went in there and bought about 5 sacks of that, bought in the house to have some combustible thing to be able to heat up the house. And like I said, for 24 hours, nobody was there. They were like, the only thing what was going on, the Russians even didn't know that. There were still shootings going on over us. Like, they were shooting from the other side was Otaki. They were shooting the other side over to them. And they, from up there, from the Ukrainian side, the Russians were shooting there. And then finally, we see a little airplane coming down there, and somebody looking up really what's going on, and later on the army marched in and they freed really the town. At that point we knew that that really we are finally free by, this is
where did you go?
We came.
Where did you go once the Russian
came? Okay, once the Russian came, it took a while. Most of them were concentrated to the army. In other words, they were mobilized to the Russian army, and was sent to fight. And a lot of them really were killed after concentration camp. Like my sister's fiance had gone to the army in the day of the 9th of May, I think was the last day of war, do I remember? He was killed the 9th of May.
You were not taken for the army.
No, I was lucky in a sense that one day, one night, okay, I had this habit to play flute. So one night I was playing the flute in the middle of the night when I used to come. I was still working in that hospital because now they were, you imagine, was a little different already. They were giving us already things and this, because before when I worked in the hospital, I didn't get anything.
So your family was still living in Mogilev. You were working now in the Ukrainian
hospital. Now just a few days.
Oh, I see.
Being that I was working in that hospital, they wouldn't pay us. Mm-hmm. Okay, money is no question. But what they were giving me there, a bread, a piece of soap, because soap was one of the hardest thing to get, because soap, my God, like gold, to clean yourself. Because like without soap, here where you work, cleaning your clothes, you didn't have boiling water, so you just washed them the way you could, and the next day you were full with lice again because they had nests of the eggs of the lice, who were forming from the warm body, they immediately would form. You had to burn really to get rid of everything. You had to burn everything and just, and even then you had to shave when we really to get rid of it, all the hair. Had to be shaven, even from all the parts of the body, because there were nests, were, and as soon as you put in new clothes, they were there. So, but coming back to how I went out of there. So I was nights, I was sitting home and practicing the flute. So one night I hear a knock in the window. And he walks in, this officer, a captain, of a Russian captain, and he starts talking with another guy, starts talking to me and says, oh, you play the flute? I said, yes. He says, oh, hello, I'm a leader of a band, of a military band, and we don't have a flutist. Do you want to come? I said, wait a minute, we just were freed, and this, look, you'll have it very good with us. Don't worry about anything. We need you. Would you be? So in my father, he convinced me I should go, and I went with them, and we crossed immediately. And we were following what we were really doing. We were following the military. Whoever occupied the town, we were, after them, we were marching with the marching band, you know? We were marching in until we came to a town a Romanian town, I forgot the name of it, in Dorohoi, not Dorohoi, Bodoshan, I think, yeah. And there we stopped, and I was there a short while, because then came a kind of decree that all the people from concentration camp should go first to their home, where they were from. They had no right, really, to take us immediately. But at first, you were housed in this, you know, and then they gave me a piece of paper that I should go home and then go to the place where you register as a military service, ready to go to service. How do you call that?
That you were drafted?
To the drafting place.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the place, to go to the drafting place, and they would register you and then decide if they need you or not. So this how I got out of there. Now my other part...
This is under the Russian...
Yeah, that's right, under the Russian. And they sent me back to Chernivtsi. When I came to Chernivtsi, my parents were already in Chernivtsi. My sister, who was in Russia, was the first to march in.
Mm-hmm.
She marched in with she wasn't a military, but she marched in together. She was in Russia and she was looking for us. So she marched in with the first column of when they freed Chernivtsi, she came in with them. She was the first to arrive there. So, and then finally, she met on the street a friend of ours who knew already that we are there. Now, I was very slow in going to the point,
draft.
You know, to the draft.
Yes.
I had enough already. So what I did, I found this guy, a friend of mine, he's now in Israel, he's a drummer. And I meet him on the street, I say, look, I have this and this, what can I do, I don't want to go. He says, I didn't want to go either, come, I'll show you what you'll do. He was working for the fire department. As a drummer, he says, he just formed an orchestra. We found one of these commanders of the fire department, who is a lover of music. And he formed an orchestra. And we need one more guy, and we'll somehow will be kept here, because the fire departments in Russia is military. So it's like being in the military, but in the town to go after fires, you know. To so we went there, and for 2 months, I was a musician there, and I was singing also Russian songs. Now, but what really happened, he didn't have no jurisdiction to really keep us there as musicians, you know, how, I mean, it was his own, you know, everybody was on his own at that point, because nobody was really, they were heroes, they marched in, he's in the fire, the captain of the fire department, and he wants an orchestra. So we had to become, all of us had to become first firemen. Firemen, is it called? Okay. So I was for 2 months, I was a firefighter. And later on, they needed drivers. So where did we get drivers? We had one machine, one car. The whole town of 200,000 had one car, really a fire car. And the rest was, we found an old-fashioned pump somewhere in the fire department. It was left over from the beginning of the 30s, probably. One of these, what you see like in the movies, you pump,
mm-hmm.
like in the middle, like a balloon, like a thing, and on the sides are handles, and you go up and down, like you've seen in the movies sometimes way back. We found one of this, so we fixed that up, and we put it on a truck with hoses,
mm-hmm.
and we had a hose to attach to the hydrant, and then the water would go in the balloon, and then we would pump it and go. We had one time a fire, I remember, in a building, in a tall building, it was about 6 stories or 7 stories high. It was a movie. It was the German movie on. And I used to live years ago across from there. It's called the I forgot the name of it, but it was the German movie. So there was a fire on the roof, and it started burning. And now we are starting to pump here, mm-hmm. and there's the guy up there on the sixth floor, and the things like on the steps, you know,
mm-hmm.
and we are pumping. I mean, no, we didn't pump. They brought prisoners to pump. There were about 8 German prisoners. They were putting them to pump there, and they pump, and the hydrant doesn't work. So the big bucket, kind of very big, and now they have a pipe going into that bucket, and this pump, and it has to go in the hydrant. It was such a joke, the whole thing. And they are pumping, and the water doesn't come, and the guy, the chief there, is up there, and he screams, "Vode!" Vode means water. And here's the fire, and he holds this, and the water doesn't come up. And you imagine with a pump like this to go up on the sixth floor. But we were lucky at that point that there was a fire department at the railroad station who had a car with this, but they had really a regular fire car, and they came and helped us in that fire. Not the whole building, it was a movie house, you know, it was burning, the roof was burning. So at that point, we had to, they needed drivers because we had to get cars and everything. So I said, I want to become a driver. And there in 44, I became a driver there at the department, at the fire department. And it was a driver for 2 years. It was a little easier because as a driver, almost 2 years. As a driver, it was easier because you could sleep at night at least. When you work night, you have to be arrested as a driver. The other ones, they don't care. So I used to sleep. Mm-hmm. Only when it was the alarm, then we had to get up and run. Mm-hmm. So you'll be alert to drive a car. It's different. And then came this exchange of... and the orchestra was still... And I was... We still were playing music. I mean, there was a musician, Halm, I don't know if it's Max Halm. Halm, I know there were two brothers. One was playing the saxophone and one was playing the violin. And this was the drummer and I played the flute. We had a nice little orchestra. And we had a pianist, very good. He was a concert pianist, Wagner. His name was Wagner. So but he was no relation. I met him here, I think, in Philadelphia one time. He came to look for me years ago. I don't know what happened to him now. So we were still doing that, and then came a kind of agreement between Romanian and Russia that all the ones who were born in Romania can be exchanged, get an authorization. You had to give up the citizenship, the Russian citizenship, and go back, go to Romania. Now, somehow, my parents were I don't know what they did by bribing or whatever, they got papers that they are from Poland. And there was also an exchange from Russia to Poland. So they went to Poland, and I went to Romania. And it probably had to do also with my sister. The older sister had a husband who was from Poland. So he somehow connected the whole, but that's not really important. And then they came out of there. In Poland was at that point in 44, I think it was a kind of anti-Semitic thing there going on.
They went to Poland in 1944?
Yes.
And you were still at that point.
I was going at that point to in 46 to Romania. They came 44 back, and they left in 45, actually. And I left a few months later. Like they left end of 45, and I left beginning of 46. So they then from Poland, being that it was some pogroms there and this, they went to Austria. And they were in Austria in a DP camp until they came to the United States.
And where did you go?
And I go to Romania. I went to Romania, and I was still 13 years in Romania because they wouldn't let me out.
Where were you in Romania?
In Temesvar, Timișoara.
Can you spell that for me?
Timișoara. Timișoara. And do you remember I told you at first an episode My father's a cousin who came back from Chile to Romania, and then they went to the hell, and then they went back. Now, one of their sons was in Russia. So he came back to Chernivtsi. And we went from Chernivtsi, I went to Romania. His parents used to live in Timișoara, and this is the reason why I went to Timișoara.
You elected to go there, to that town?
Yes, because his parents were living there. We didn't have anybody in Romania. Because when he came back, he was completely, you could see lice running over his, so my father took him, took all his clothes, dropped it into fire, burned it up, shaved everything off of him, gave him a whole good bath, and put new clothes on.
So you and this cousin went together?
Yes. Yeah, and yeah, he was apart, and there was another cousin who we were together, and it was a whole, I wasn't alone there. I stayed with this cousin because he was a dentist. And I used to, after the war, I started working. Besides being a working dentistry with him, a dental mechanic. And this is the reason why my parents would accept for me to stay, because I was with him very close, because he was a doctor in dentistry, and I was working with him together. And that then when we came to Romania, we had this cousin also, the one what came from Russia, what has his parents in Timișoara, who were waiting for him to leave to go to South America, because he was, they were already here after concentration camp, and the son wasn't there.
So you left for Timișoara in 1946.
Yes. And there I stayed for till 51, and registered to go to Israel. I didn't know about my parents, where they are, whatever.
You had no idea where your parents were.
No. In 49, after 3 years, they found me. They were in Austria. They were in Salzburg. And they found me somehow, I don't know how. And they started to send me gifts and money to be able to survive, because I was just like a...
What kind of work were you doing in Timișoara?
Dentistry
again.
Yes. And now, I also, at that point in Timișoara, I started to go to college there. It was to become a dentist. To become a dentist, you didn't need to go 4 years to school. I told you the difference between a dentist and a doctor. So after 1 year, I got the approval that I can become a dentist if I work under a doctor, like the way I was at first when I learned the profession. So you had to have only a name there that